श्री गुरुभ्यो नमः ओम श्री गणेशाय नमः ओम ऐं सरस्वत्ये नमः
Sounds True presents Mantra, Sacred Words of Power, with author, spiritual teacher, and priest in the Vedic tradition for nearly 25 years, Thomas Ashley Ferrand. And now, Session 1, The Origins of Mantra.
We have a bias in modern spirituality that says that light is the highest signpost of spirituality and divinity, even. We have lots of evidence to support this conclusion. We have the light surrounding the Christ. We have the nimbus, the halo surrounding the saints. There is light that surrounds the priests who carry and work with the Ark of the Covenant in Judaism. We see the Buddha, who has a halo. Many of us pray for light on the path, and we seek a goal which we call enlightenment. So we're pretty clear that light must be the beginning, the middle, and the end of our journey. But I suggest to you that that's not really the case, that sound is rather the beginning and the highest in terms of divinity, more than light. I know it's an outrageous statement. But let me present some evidence to support that. In the Bible, in the Old Testament again, God did various things before he created light. I suggest that if light was the highest spiritual quality, he would have created that first, but he didn't. In the New Testament Gospel of John, it states, "In the beginning was the Word." Now, light was not the beginning. Rather, it was sound in the form of divine speech. Neither in the Old Testament nor the New Testament do we find a verse such as, "And God made light to shine." Rather, God creates the phenomenon of light by speaking it. The primary mechanism of creation is sound. "And God said, let there be light." The Christian portion of the Bible was written a couple of thousand years ago in the Old Testament before that. But the Saptama Brahma from the Far East was written a couple of thousand years before even that, and may be much older. I quote from Sir John Woodruff's Garland of Letters that has a translation of a portion of that scripture. "In the beginning was God with power through speech. God said, may I be many, may I be propagated, and by his will expressed through subtle speech, he united himself with that speech and became pregnant. Prajapati and Saraswati were then created." This statement sure sounds to me astonishingly like the Gospel of John. In other places in the Far East, in Chinese Buddhism, there is a figure called Kuan Yin. Now, she's referred to as the divine voice, which has called forth the elusive form of this universe. The Vedas, the world's oldest recorded scriptures, speak of the divine sound current, Shabda Brahma, which permeates and has created all. Modern teachers also speak of the power of spiritual sound. Sufi mystic master Hazrat Inayat Khan has written, "Divine sound is the cause of all manifestation. The knower of the mystery of sound knows the mystery of this whole universe." In the early part of the 20th century, there's a movement which I've called modern esotericism. It includes such people as H.P. Blavatsky, Alice Bailey, Rudolf Steiner, Helena and Nicholas Roerich, and others. Here is a quote from The Secret Doctrine written by H.P. Blavatsky, who also founded the Theosophical Society. "Sound is such a tremendous occult power. It is such a stupendous force that the electricity generated by a million Niagaras could never counteract even the smallest potentiality when directed by proper knowledge." In the East, they describe the process of creation in these steps. First, we have God, whatever that is, as being. And then from being comes mind. And then from mind springs desire. And to bring desire to manifestation comes the will. And from the will comes the word, the ineffable word. And from the word comes everything else. So here we are with the creative power of sound, and we can see how it has created the universe and how it is all-pervading. But what is that to you and me? How can we use sound to affect the issues in our life? What is the power of this sound, and how does it work? Well, the one I'm familiar with, among several ways, is Sanskrit mantra. Now, Sanskrit is an ancient tongue. We can trace it back 7,000 to 8,000 years, and then we lose track of it in the mists of time. It was widely used before the advent of writing, so it is part of an oral tradition. And it is the language of the chakras. And as we'll get into a little bit later in this course, it is an energy-based language. Its very essence is to work with the building blocks of creation through sound that are reproduced in you and me. The way we work with this Sanskrit language, this language of the chakras, is through Sanskrit mantras. Now, mantras are spiritual formulas. They are sounds put together in a particular way, one might say even a scientific way, to produce specific kinds of results. And so powerful are these sound formulas called mantras that they were hidden for many thousands of years. They were hidden and taught only within the Brahmin priesthood. And then later they started to leak out from the priesthood into the outside secular world. And this was, spiritually speaking, not a good thing. And as we'll talk about later, one of the tasks of the Buddha was to stop this movement, which he did brilliantly. But even with this interesting background, understanding that Sanskrit mantras are tools for power and tools of power, the tools of the spoken word, language of the chakras that you and I can use, how can we use them? What will they do for us? Well, all of us have had job issues from time to time. Sanskrit mantras can help you with whatever problems you may have in your job, or its cousin, income. We all from time to time have had little bumps in our relationship. We'd like to be able to make it better, to optimize our relationship. Maybe it's something in the other person. Maybe it's something in us. Maybe we don't know. There are Sanskrit mantras that will help you with this. Health issues are something we all have. There are formulas that you can use that will help you promote health in ways that are frankly astonishing. And later in this course, I'll tell you some stories of people who used mantras for specific problems and the results they had, sometimes dramatic results. Another thing that I call karmic speed bumps as we go through the parking lot of life, the things that come out of nowhere that present themselves and you go, what am I going to do about this? There are mantras for those kinds of situations as well. Ultimately, the purpose of Sanskrit mantra is spiritual. We can use it to solve worldly problems. We can use it for health issues. But what they are really about are spiritual evolution. We hear about meditation. It's part of the common lexicon these days. And one form of meditation, and among many forms, is mantra meditation. And that is the primary kind of meditation that we'll be talking about in this course. How you can take specific Sanskrit formulas and move yourself along spiritually, evolve towards a goal which is called mukti or liberation, where you will no longer have to return to this earthly school. So while we'll be presenting mantras for you that will help you in the problems that you encounter, we also want you to know that the final objective is really spiritual. In the Divine Comedy by Dante, as Dante the Pilgrim ascends through the various levels of hell, he encounters all of the human negative issues, greed, lust, avarice, gluttony, those kinds of things. And Sanskrit mantras are designed to almost effortlessly eliminate those kinds of qualities as we progress spiritually. The I Ching has a wonderful statement. It says, the best way to combat evil is to make energetic progress towards the good. And Sanskrit mantras help you make energetic progress towards the good. And so if we can serve your interests in that regard during this course, we will have achieved our objective. I'm often asked, how did you get involved with all of this stuff? Did you just decide one day that you were going to become a teacher of Sanskrit mantra? The answer is certainly not. I whimsically say that I was drafted. Here I am, living a normal, ordinary, everyday life. I've been an army captain. I've got a master's degree. I'm a business consultant. I'm working as a television producer. And I'm working on a business project one day in my living room. A friend of mine and I were making a proposal to Muhammad Ali for a television project. When all of a sudden, on the notepad in front of me, there appeared a perfect circle of bright white light. And in it was a brief message that was personal in nature, and I won't go into it here. But it was startling in my everyday world. But it wasn't finished. I then began to rise out of my body with one part. And I saw the universe, my small living room portion of the universe, split in two, complete duplicates, as one started to leave and one stayed there. A third part of me began to descend into an opening that had suddenly appeared in my chest, and I was descending into my own heart. I knew beyond doubt I was going to die. Now, I can tell you that this gets your attention right away. I was panic-stricken. No, who wants to die? Well, the experience lasted another 60 seconds or so, which I tell you is a very long time. I finally managed to bring myself around to a normal state, and within 30 seconds was on the phone to various religious organizations of my childhood in Western spirituality. None of them had any answers and frankly couldn't wait to get me off the phone. Here's some other nutcase calling. Finally, I called an Eastern-based organization, and they suggested that I call the only holy man they knew at the time on the East Coast, and that was in Philadelphia. I was in Washington, D.C. So I called Philadelphia, and I spoke to a wonderful man by the name of Vijayendra Pratap, who was teaching Hatha Yoga there. And he very kindly gave me some breathing exercises, suggested I read the Upanishads, and when I told him what was happening to me, he laughed uproariously. Now, this was the kind of laugh that your best friend would break out with if you told him some fool stunt you'd pulled and the trouble it got you into. It was a warm laugh. It was an intimate laugh. And so the part of me that was deeply concerned about life and death began to relax. Well, I followed his suggestions and began to read the Upanishads and other things voraciously, seeking answers. And I came across a scripture called the Katha Upanishad. The Katha Upanishad is a conversation between a young spiritual protege, Nichiketas, and Yama, the god of death. And in that conversation, Yama begins to explain the mysteries of the cave of the heart. When I came across that passage, my eyes stopped dead on the page. Time slowed down, and I read every word, not wanting to miss one single nuance. And there in front of me, my most profound and terrifying experience unfolded in a scripture written over 8,000 years ago. And I knew, there's nothing new. Everything is known by someone, somewhere. I just realized I didn't know anything at all about anything that really mattered. And so there I began. That was in 1970. I've been halfway around the world, met many spiritual teachers, famous and anonymous. There was, of course, one teacher that I spent about 11 years with. And after I'd been with him a couple of years, and he could see that I had both interest and facility in Sanskrit mantras, he said, very good. Your job will be to spread the ancient teachings in the West. And so my intention is to share some of the things that I've learned over the years with you so that you can solve the problems that confront you in daily life and use them just as I do. The question arises, where do Sanskrit mantras come from? Where did we get these spiritual formulas to solve problems? What's the genesis? The truth is, no one knows for sure. There certainly weren't any written records. The oral tradition went on for many thousands of years before the advent of writing. So I'm asking you to picture a scene in the foothills of the Himalayas in the Indus River Valley, many thousands of years ago. You have a primarily agrarian economy. There's pottery, there's music, there is some painting, there is not writing. But there is a level of sophistication. One day, one or two from among their number has an irresistible impulse and leaves the village and trods up the slowly rising foothills and finds a comfortable place under a tree and sits in meditation spontaneously and after some time begins to chant loudly. It echoes through the foothills and in the village below, some people hear and go to investigate. Now, because the oral tradition is used, it's much easier for people to remember what they hear. It's part of their culture. So as they sit there, listening to this person chanting these things, they remember. So they can then go down the hill and report. Well, Joe was up here sitting under a tree, and he started talking about this great being that's divine, and we're all part of it, and we can understand how it works and how we're part of it. And when I left, he was on the 27th way to achieve that, using the language that we use in a different way called Sanskrit. That was the beginning of the oral records of these scriptures. Regularly, people would go up into the foothills, and this much we do know, that people would follow them up and sit and memorize as people would spontaneously go into meditation and begin to chant what we know today as the world's oldest scripture. With the advent of writing, people began to write down what they heard on palm leaves. In fact, whole families became librarians, and it was everyone's task to record them. And when the leaves would start to rot from fungi or become brittle, they would recopy them onto new leaves. And whole houses were devoted to storing the leaves. Well, after several hundred years, as you can imagine, they ran out of room. So they decided to summarize, and a whole wall became a couple of shelves. And then they had plenty of room again. And this went on for several hundred more years. And what we have today are scriptures called the Brahmanas and the Aryankas and the Upanishads, which are summaries of the summaries of the summaries of those ancient scriptures. The only ones which are not summarized are what we know today as the Vedas, the four Vedas. And we had another series of documents that are a wealth of information called the Puranas. The Puranas are a series of stories and myths that contain mantras and how to use them in solving some of the problems of life. So in this course, we'll be drawing mantras from the Vedas, the Upanishads, and the Puranas. And that is how, as we loosely understand it, Sanskrit mantras came to us those many thousands of years ago. What about those people that went up the mountain, that answered that inner call, that sat and closed their eyes in meditation? Today, we would call them rishis, or sages, or seers. A seer is one who really sees the mantra and how it works. And from those early ones, we have whole classes of spiritual adepts, each with a different kind of name. We have the Brahma Rishi, the Maha Rishi, the Raja Rishi, the Deva Rishi, and various kinds of saints. We have Gandharvas, the celestial musicians. But those first ones were the spiritual geniuses of their time, the proteges, the prototypes of all that we know today about Sanskrit mantra. They were the first sages many thousands of years ago. These spiritual geniuses, one of the first things they chanted was something called the Purusha Suktam. the hymn to the transcendental over-self, that great being from which we have all come, that great being of which we are all a part. It is the fire, and we are the flames. And that hymn to that being says, the transcendental person has 1,000 heads, 1,000 faces, 1,000 arms. Those heads and faces and arms are you and me. And then it goes on to talk about the world at large and how this transcendental person also created the birds that fly and the streams that flow, and taught about how the different varieties of humanity have sprung from parts of the transcendental Purusha, how the kings come from one form, and the warriors come from another, and those who work in the fields come from another part, but that it's all a unified whole working together. So profoundly were these ancient seers touched that when they came out of meditation, they said, how can we represent such a truth? How can we propitiate such a being? And so they decided to create ceremonies which can express that which is sometimes inexpressible. They gathered flowers and arranged them. They took the spring rains and they made an oblation representing the spirit of that being over rocks and various artifacts that they would gather. And thus the world's first religious ceremonies as we know them came to being. Even the modern forms of the Catholic Mass are drawn from those ancient ceremonies with their incense and flowers and chants for this purpose and that purpose. To give you a taste, a flavor of what those ancient ceremonies were like and are like today, because some of them have been done exactly the same way for thousands and thousands of years, I'd like to chant for you the Purusha Suktam, which is that hymn to that great being, that great fire, and you may use it as a meditation. It will be 3 to 3.5 minutes long. It's advisable to sit quietly, comfortably, with the spine erect, the trunk straight and steady, the head sitting comfortably on the top of the spine without tension. If you have a tight belt or tight shoes, you can take them off. If you're driving in your car, be aware that this chant produces a lot of energy. So take care to keep your energy focused on the road. If you feel like it's getting the better of you, pull off. Pull into a driveway and listen and then go on your way. You may feel the energy moving very strongly in the spine, where the major chakras reside. And this will work directly on your chakras.
हरि ओम सहस्रशीर्षः पुरुषः सहस्रक्षः सहस्रपत् सभूमिं विश्वतो वृत्वा अत्युत्तिष्ठत् शृङ्गलम् ओम पुरुषै वेदं सर्वं याद्भुतं यच्च भाव्यम् उथामृतत्वाच् येषानः यतन्नेनाते रोहति ओम एतावनस्य महिमत् अथो जयंश्च पुरुषः पादोस्य विश्वभूतानि त्रिभार्य मृतं दिवि ॐ क्षुपात् मृत्वा उदैत्पुरुषः पादोस्येहा भवत् पुनः ततो विश्वं व्यक्रामत् साशनानाशनयवि ॐ तस्माद्विरारजयता व्रजो आदिपुरुषः स चतो अचिरिच्यता पाशाद् भूमिमातो पराः ॐ यत्पुरुषेण हविषा देवा यद्मामतन्वत वसन्तो अस्यासीदर्जम् ग्रीष्मा इद्मा शरादभिः ॐ तं यद्मम् वारिषि प्राक्षान् पुरुषम् च समागताः तेन देव अयजन्ता सद्या ऋषयश्च ये ॐ तस्माद्धद्मत्सर्वभूतः संवसम् पशराजम् पशोंस्तम् चक्रे वायव्यानारण्यम् गरम्यश्च ये ॐ तस्माद्धद्मत्सर्वभूतः ऋचः सामानि जत्नरी छम्बंसि जत्नरे तस्माजुसंसारजयत ॐ तस्मादश्वाजयन्त ये केचो वयरतः gavo hajnari tasma dasma jata ajavyaha om yat purusham yararahu katidaha vyakalpayamna mukham kimasya kao bahuka urupada ujete om brahmanusya mukamasi bahu rajanyaha kitaha urutachayarvaishaha padyam sujo ajayata om chandrama manaso dataha chakshoho suryo ajayataha Mukadindrashchagnishya pranadvaya rajayata Om nabhya asidantariksham shushnyaudya samavattata Padhyam bumirisha shutraba tatallakan nakalpayam Om saptasya sanparidayaha Tusapta vidakitaha Devayadyadnam tanvanhaha padnam purusham pasham Om yadnenu yadnamaya janta deva Sani dharmani pradamanyasan Dehana kammahimanaha Sachanta yatra purvehi sadyaha santirivaha Purusha suktam japadhyanam samartayami
So now you've had a taste of how the Sanskrit language sounds and how it sounded those many thousands of years ago from those seers sitting under the trees with their eyes closed. We're pronouncing the mantras in the same way and the hymns in the same way. You could probably feel the power of it. It is working directly on your chakras. Over the years, I've had people say to me, well, can't I say the same kinds of things in English and have the same kinds of effects? Well, there are things called affirmations that we say in English, but affirmations are quite different than Sanskrit mantras. Affirmations work more on the subconscious mind in the sense of beginning to program and condition those parts of ourselves that may need positive reinforcement. But Sanskrit is about energy. It works directly on the chakras. And it is an energy-based language rather than a meaning-based language. So the experience of working with Sanskrit mantra will be dislodging things that are stored in your legs, in your arms, various thoughts and emotions that may be stored throughout the body. And by the action of the Sanskrit will actually dislodge them and remove them. They will be pulled back into the spine and ejected. Just as surely as a jet plane pilot can eject himself from his plane by pushing a button, Sanskrit mantra is a button we can use to eject streams of negativity that we no longer wish to carry about. The two languages that are energy-based rather than meaning-based, in my experience, are Sanskrit and Hebrew. The Kabbalah is also a powerful, codified system of working with energy through sound. Having acknowledged that, I can't talk much about it. It's not my area of expertise. But Sanskrit, I can talk about. The power of mantra will be expressed exclusively in Sanskrit, and there will be words for which there is no English translation, because the Sanskrit word is about energy and not about meaning. The best place to start for that is seed mantras, because seed mantras have no translation at all into English. They are short, usually one, sometimes two-syllabled words, that are about certain kinds of energy. And we're going to go through some of the seed mantras, which are then used to build longer mantras. Before we get into seed sounds, I would be remiss if I didn't explain what mantra means insofar as it's translatable. Manas is the Sanskrit word for mind, and many scholars say that the tra part comes from the word tri, which means to free from. So at its essence, mantra is a tool used by the mind to free one from the mind. When you say a mantra, you begin a vibration that begins to permeate the body and permeate the cells. And as we know, all kinds of thoughts are constantly riding in and through our mind, our psycho-spiritual mechanism. And the power of the mantra begins to absorb all of those until it becomes the one great wave of vibration. So the way mantras work is to help you arrive at a state of tranquility where your mind is silent from all of the subconscious waves of thoughts and ideas that are sweeping through it all the time. And when the mind is quiet, it can really concentrate and it can really think. So the mind then can achieve a state that we call concentration, where you can think on one thing without wandering. Have you ever sat and tried to just think about one thing? You'll sit there and then you'll think, let's see, what am I going to have for dinner later? Or, boy, that was a great movie we saw. Oh, yes, I'm thinking about X. I'm thinking about Y. And, oh, my, I got to scratch my leg over here. The mind does not stay one-pointed. If you sit and observe your own mind, it's all over the place. Well, mantra can help bring the mind to a state of one-pointedness. The basic building blocks of mantras are seed sounds. And just as the name implies, it contains within it the seed or the germ of a particular kind of power. Just as we know that an entire oak tree is contained within an acorn, in principle, ready to sprout and grow. Similarly, seed sounds contain an entire principle ready to sprout and grow within as we say the mantra. So that's why we call them seed sounds. And by saying them, we tend them, we water them, we give them sunlight, and those principles grow within us. All right, what are they? Let's take the first one as abundance. Now, abundance means many things to many different kinds of people. We tend to think of it as prosperity. We want more means to support our family, to live the kind of lifestyle we want. So we think that abundance is prosperity. But in fact, abundance can mean many different kinds of things. In an agrarian economy, abundance was having a large enough family to be able to tend the crops. If you are a person living alone, abundance is having friends and acquaintance. It can be enough food to eat. So the seed sound for abundance includes all of these kinds of abundance. I'll chant it for you three times. Shreem. 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 Simple, isn't it? Shreem. Each one of these seed sounds has become associated with an anthropomorphized principle. We've all heard of the Hindu pantheon, the gods and goddesses. And there are two schools of thought on the gods and goddesses. One of them is, well, these are symbols that can be used for our mind to focus on various principles. And that is probably true. There's another school that says, these beings once existed, became liberated, and decided to stick around here and help us. And now we know them through their seed sounds. Well, this can sound outrageous, except we think about the Catholic saints and the Greek gods and goddesses and the ancestors who've gone before. And we find that many cultures throughout history have this tradition of those who are on another plane that were once here that are helping us. So I wouldn't dismiss it quite so quickly that these are only anthropomorphized principles. Ultimately, it doesn't matter whether they once existed or whether they are anthropomorphized principles, because they work. So for the seed sound that I gave you, shreem, the anthropomorphized principle is a beautiful feminine figure called Lakshmi. She's shown standing on a flower pad, her outstretched hands, there's money coming out of it, and there are elephants in the background with upraised trunks, which, as you probably know, are a symbol of good luck in the Far East. Beautiful woman, Lakshmi, Shreem. Now, if you want to experiment, you can start just saying to yourself out loud or even silently, Shreem, 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 Shreem. I once experimented. I went to bed one night and decided I was going to say Shreem as much as I could between the time I went to bed and the time I got up the next morning. Now, naturally, you fall off to sleep saying Shreem. The next morning, I went down to breakfast, and I said hello, and the person that was sitting at the breakfast table said, your voice, it sounds completely different. What have you been doing? And I knew that the power of the Shreem mantra had already begun to change the tenor of my voice, and I'd said it maybe, 5,000-10,000 times. But that was my feedback from the universe, as it were, that already the Shreem mantra was beginning to work. Now, as you will see, these are also building blocks. There are mantras later on that will contain the word Shreem in it. So you can start saying the seed, and then later you can say a longer mantra that contains the seed. So here are some other seeds. I'm. This is a seed sound that rules artistic, scientific, and educational endeavors. The anthropomorphized principle there is Saraswati, Saraswati. And this is the seed sound that governs development and manifestation of spiritual knowledge, also good education, memory, intelligence, musical skills. And it is the name of this feminine principle that many highly developed sages in India have taken as part of their own name. Dayananda Saraswati, Brahmananda Saraswati, where they put the name of this feminine principle as part of their own spiritual name, which shows you in what high regard they hold this energy and the seed sound. I'm. So, if you want to improve your own education, your own musical skills, you may chant the mantra, I'm. In fact, in parts of India, women chant it for their children so that they'll do well in school. They'll chant I'm, or the longer Saraswati mantra that we'll talk about a bit later. The next seed sound is Kleem. Kleem. And it is the principle of attraction. Isn't that interesting? It attracts things. It's like a little spiritual energy magnet. And it can attract almost anything, which is why it is often used in combination with other seed sounds to improve or enhance the qualities that they represent. Now, I'm going to chant a longer Lakshmi mantra that uses the seed sound we talked about, Shreem, and this one, Kleem, the principle of attraction, and the name of the anthropomorphized principle, which is Lakshmi, principle of abundance, and Namaha, which means I salute. So the literal translation of what I'm going to say would be seed sound Om, which we'll talk about, seed sound Shreem for abundance, seed sound Kleem for attraction, salutations to the principle of abundance. It sounds like this. Om Shreem Kleem Lakshmiye Namaha. Om Shreem Kleem Lakshmiye Namaha. Om Shreem Kleem Lakshmiye Namaha. And if you are after abundance, this is a wonderful mantra for you to use. And you can just start saying it. And say it when you get up in the morning. Say it while you're taking your shower. Say it while you're driving your car. Om Shreem Kleem Lakshmiye Namaha. Om Shreem Kleem Lakshmiye Namaha. Claim is also used to attract other principles. The great feminine principle Kali, for instance, that we'll talk about a little later, a mantra is Om Klim Kalikaye Namaha. Om Klim Kalikaye Namaha. And there it's attracting the Kali principle. In another context, Om Klim Krishnaya Namaha. Om Klim Krishnaya Namaha. There it's used to attract that being, that avatar of Vishnu that was known as Krishna. So you see the seed sound Klim as the principle of attraction has a wide variety of applications. If you want to use the principle of attraction by itself, the best way to do it is to concentrate on that which is desired. So you couple it with mental intention so that you give something for the Klim to hang on to, as it were. So you're employing the seed sound through the power of sound Klim, and you're using it as an attachment to an object in your mind. You can sit, for instance, and gaze at a candle and think about that which you desire and go Klim, Klim. Of course, there's an old saying in the Far East, be careful what you ask for. You just might get it.